My name is Nancy Pearl, and how I define myself is probably the $64,000 question, because I am a librarian and a book reviewer who has written books about good books to read.
You said you find yourself in several ways there, but is the librarian, are both the and librarian capitalized?
The librarian? No.
No?
No, I wouldn't presume to capitalize the L.
Now, do you mind if we do?
No, then. Okay. I'd be honored, but all I'm right. Not going to do it myself.
Okay. Great. Well, okay, so you have a lifetime of experience as the librarian and a writer and a reader, a voracious reader.
Yes.
And a media personality who talks in these ways. How did this all happen? Where did it start?
Well, I've asked myself a lot about how I ended up where I am doing what I am. And it all begins, I think, with reading. And I was, as a child, a reader. It was a way to deal with a sometimes unpleasant, unhappy childhood, to lose myself in books and reading.
Uh-huh. What
and
part of the country did you grow up
in? I grew up in Detroit.
Ah.
At a time when Detroit was really pretty much a viable city, and not having gotten to the place where it is today. But certainly the seeds of that destruction, self-destruction, were there. But I read, and my parents, you know, encouraged my reading, and I had, along with that, a relationship. I spent all my spare time at the library, my local library, Parkman Branch Library of the Detroit Public Library System. I spent all my free time there, every day after school, all day Saturday, whenever it was open, I was there. And there was a librarian, a children's librarian, who really took me in hand and opened up the world of books and reading to me. And so when I was 10 years old, I knew that I wanted to be a librarian.
Seriously, from 10?
From 10. A children's librarian, just like Miss Whitehead.
Yeah.
Because I also had that kind of strain, that sort of do-gooding strain. And I thought, well, what could be better? What could I do to make the world a better place than do for other children what Miss Whitehead did for me and give me that gift of loving to read and of this wide range of books that she would put into my hand.
Now, did you have books at home?
We did have books at home. My mother was a huge, huge, huge science fiction and fantasy fan.
Oh, really?
So we had many of those, and my father loved history and political science, that kind of thing.
Did you have a bookcase library in the house?
We didn't have. We were very poor. We had very little money. So I remember owning maybe three books, all horse and dog books.
Yeah.
But somehow, at least in my memory, there are books around. They're just. You know, I remembered that my father had a copy of Norman Mailer's The Naked and the Dead.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
wow.
Which I remember trying to read at like age 10.
Yes.
And then Dr. Spock. My mother had a copy of Dr. Spock, and it was a little paperback, and I would look through it and see the little cartoony, the drawings. But I don't remember other books, and just the three books that I remember that I had. Miss Whitehead gave me The Hobbit to read, and then when I finished that, she and my mother read The Hobbit after I did, and then she gave me The Fellowship of the Ring, and you know, The Fellowship of the Ring ends with Frodo and Sam running into Mirkwood, and they're being chased by Boromir, who wants the ring that Frodo has, and then that the book ends, and it took a year or two for the next book, The Two Towers, to come to be published in the United States. So it's not, wasn't like now.
Oh, so you were right there
on the edge. I was right there on the edge. It was like those kids with the Harry Potter books.
Right.
You know, who read them at exactly the right age, because there was that interim between between the books coming yeah. out. So that was, you know, that waiting on edge for the next book, would Frodo and Sam be saved and everything, was just so, it was just such an immense experience. But I remember Miss Whitehead, when she met me, all I read were horse and dog books. And if you...
Did you read Steinbeck's The Red Pony?
Oh, not even that. Not even at that level. I'm talking about, like, Pennies for a Pony by okay. some British writer that's okay. no longer around, or Taffy's Foal, I remember, Lad a Dog, all that kind of thing. And that's and like, if you took me back into that library today, I could show you where the horse and dogs were, books were kept. I mean, I could walk there, I think, probably blindfolded and blind. And Miss Whitehead, really good librarian that she was, wanted to expand my reading experience. And so she would say to me, Nancy, a new horse book just came in the library. Would you like to be the first person Whoa. To check it out? Well, I mean, imagine
Status.
Being the first person to check out a library book. So exciting. And I would say, yes, of course. And, you know, I'd like... Time after time, she could fool me this way. I would hold out my hands, expecting her to give it to me. And she would say, oh, but first, I want you to read this other book. And you know, so that way, she introduced me to the classics of British children's literature, the classics of, she was Canadian, of you know, the Canadian, what little few Canadian writers there were available at that time for kids. But gradually... You know, I just branched out, and but I remember doing what a lot of readers did, going into the libraries, you know, vowing I was going to start with the A's and right. read, you know, and getting bogged down somewhere. But I do remember going through the A's, and those, I think, those days, those, you know, maybe age 10 to age 17 or so. Those were great, great years for reading oh. for me.
Now, obviously, you were caught up in the stories then.
I was caught up Not- in, I was caught up in the lives, I think, of the characters.
Uh-huh.
You know, I obviously that story plays into it,
right.
but it was, even now, I thought recently, and I tweeted this because it occurred to me, was why I read, is there are so many lives, so many things that I wish I had done, so many things, so many lives I wish I could have led, and I read, that's why I read, so I can live those lives.
That's brilliant.
So
that's beautiful. That is beautiful. There you are, you're reading through the library.
Right.
And here's this tricky mentor librarian.
Right. Yes.
Is she still around?
No, she is not. She is not. She died very young. I got my library degree and went back. My first job after library school was with the Detroit Public Library. So I worked as her colleague.
So you got to go back?
I got to go back. Not to that branch library, which would have been heaven because it was like
yes.
my home. But at the same time that I was doing all that reading, I was writing. I was writing at that time mostly poetry.
Uh-huh.
And
well,
you know,
and like, what poets were your inspiration? Edna St. Vincent Millay.
Yes, Edna St. Vincent. Good for you.
Oh.
Edna St. Vincent Millay was a big,
yes.
you know, because there was a wonderful biography of her for children that I read, and uh-huh. so that inspired me. I won. At that time, they had Scholastic Writing Awards, and I won many awards for my poetry, and, you know, always defined myself as a writer, you know, as a writer.
Have you kept any of those poems?
I have all those poems.
Do you really?
Or
oh,
many of
nice.
Those poems, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that writing, you know, that poetry writing continued pretty much into my 20s, and then... What used to come to me as poetry, as lines of poetry, started coming to me as what was clearly prose, which was shocking and, you know, a little disturbing, because what do you do with that?
Yeah.
So one of the lines that came to me in my 20s was my mother, let's see, my mother talked to us all the time. And that, so that's not poetry. That's,
but it
that's
has a rhythm.
Prose. It does
it's
have a rhythm.
It's a poetic rhythm to it.
It does have a rhythm. Well, I turned that into a short story.
Mm.
And then it was published in Red Book magazine when Red Book was doing really good short stories.
Oh,
Bobby Ann Mason.
The great
other
days.
So that was published then. And, you know, they said, oh, we'd love the story. Send us everything. And so I would send them the stories that I was writing. When they were, you know, done, I would mail them off, and then they would send them back and say, oh, this is just gorgeously written, but it's too sad for our readers. So then after that, I kind of stopped.
Have you continued with the... Are you envisioning a novel someday?
Well, you know, I'm working on a novel.
You are, okay.
But I have to say, it's, I am cursed. I am not a perfectionist in any other area of my life. I am someone who has always prided herself on getting things done when they needed to get done. But with writing, especially writing this, I'm a perfectionist and a procrastinator and a vicious editor. The older I get, the more critical I get of the books that I read.
Yes.
And that, of course, has totally spilled over into my writing. So, you know, I'll do a sentence like, George took Lizzie's arm, which makes perfect sense. I mean, that's a good first draft or whatever. George took Lizzie's arm. And then I'll stop and I'll think, well, where did he take it? You know, like, what did she do without that arm?
Eat, shoot, sneeze.
Yes, exactly. That makes no sense at all. And then I'll just be paralyzed. So it's going so slowly.
Okay, circling back.
Yes.
Out of the realm of the written word.
Yes.
I'm curious, have you ever, as a librarian, studied or looked into the history of libraries? Is that a topic of interest?
Well, I'm sure in library school I took a course in that.
Okay.
And the history of the book,
yeah.
The Incunabula and all that. But what has always interested me about being a librarian is putting people together with books that they would like.
Ah.
And so...
Just as your mentor had done with you.
Just as my mentor, exactly, had done with me. And I've, over the years, based on stuff that other librarians have done and written about, come up with a theory of why people enjoy the books that they enjoy and how to translate by listening to what somebody says about a book, how to translate that into suggesting books that they might enjoy.
Are you an artist in this way?
I'm very good at it.
I bet you
I'm
are.
Very, very good at it. And I get to teach that theory at the University of Washington's Information School.
Ah.
So I've been doing that for, gosh, a long time. I mean, we like books for very mysterious reasons, and, you know, it sort of all goes back to the fact that no two readers read the same book. You know, right. we can both... No two readers experience the same book in the same way, and it's how you experience that sort of reading experience that you want replicated in your next book.
And even when you've read it once and come back to it a month, a year, a lifetime later, it's a different book.
Because every time you read it, you bring all of your life's experiences to that book at that moment. And that, plus your mood, you have to throw in your mood too, which, you know, was like a spanner in the wrench, and what you ate that morning and how hot it is and everything that's happening to you goes into reading that book. So I could make a good argument, and it sounds like you could too, George, that there's no such thing as rereading, because you're always reading a different version of that book.
Where are libraries going to go? Are they going to be the same?
I don't think they can be the same. I think that libraries, I think that the advent of technology, I think that this, you know, this huge change, technological change that occurred in the late 20th century really took libraries in many ways by surprise. And I think that our initial reaction was, you know, this kind of bewilderment and trying to figure out how to define libraries and librarians in the face of this technology. So at one time there was discussion early on, you know, that our job as librarians would be to help people decide what websites were the most useful or the ones that you could believe or something like that. My sense of the profession of library science is that it's always been a very reactive profession rather than a proactive profession, not unlike a lot of things.
Yeah.
And the way we reacted to technology was to, rather than say, how can technology help us do our work in a more exciting or better way, which it certainly could and does, we said, how does our job fit into this world of technology? And I think that was the wrong path that the libraries went. This is just my opinion, I don't know. That the libraries went down. So technology started overshadowing everything else that libraries did. And now, I mean, I think the balance is being a little bit brought back into a kind of proper alignment. I mean, in my view, libraries do three things. They provide information. It's like a three-legged stool. They provide information. They help people find their next good book. And they are a community meeting place, programming and all that other stuff that goes on. And if those legs are not the same length, if you're neglecting one or two of them, that stool is going to be really tippy.
Oh.
Right. And so, you know, so those other two legs, technology was, you know, the big leg, and the other two were pretty much ignored. So where libraries are going, I mean, I think the big job that libraries have is to help people see that you need a building, that a library is a building. It's the heart of the community. It's the place where people of all races and ethnicities and ages and economic levels and come together, and once they walk through that door, they are equal. A lot of people believe that with Google, with Wikipedia, with people having computers at home, with iPhones, any smartphone, what do you need a library for? Except as a place maybe to pick up books. So you sit at home, you read the New York Times, you put books on hold, you get a notice, you run in and pick them up, and you never spend any time browsing the shelves or looking, you know, that kind of serendipitous wonder that you can find in a library. But I believe that nearly every book that you read, you learn something from. You're in a character's experience, in their shoes. And the more we can get out of ourselves, we spend so much time in our own selves, the more we can get out of it into other people's and be other people, the more understanding we are, the kinder we are. I mean, all of those good qualities, I think, you can get from reading.
Yeah.
That's my lecture.
I took notes.
Well, I love the fact that you give people permission to not finish books that just don't resonate with
yes.
them. Yes. Doesn't mean they're a bad book or a bad
right.
reader.
Right. Yeah, I think that's really important. I mean, my father was the kind of father where we had to finish what we started. So whether it was, you know, I went to a college that was the... You know, I made a very bad decision in going to the first college that I went to, and I really wanted to quit and come home. And my father absolutely refused that I had to do that for 2 years. And that was really hard. And I, you know, decided then that I would never make my children do something that they really didn't want to do. And I saw that even more in my reading, that if I didn't like a book, it didn't matter how many awards that book won or who else loved that book. If I didn't like it, all it meant was that at that moment, it wasn't the right book for me. And why not put it down and realize that you can pick it up at a later time if you want. And so, you know, nowadays, because I have become such a critical, I call myself a vicious reader, but because I'm
a vicious reader,
that I probably start 12 to 15 books for every book that I will actually finish.
Really?
Now, that's not to say that I don't go back to some of those books later and enjoy them, mm-hmm. but it's just, you know, we forget how important mood is.
Yes.
In our reading. And so I always wanted to, you know, like free people up. I hate it when somebody says, oh, you know, I'm just slogging through this book and I just want to rip the book out of their hands. Say, stop. It's not worth it. Reading should be joy. I mean, I read on an electronic device when forced to. So, you know, I did a walking trip in England in May and June of this year, and I did take, I took my iPad,
yeah.
And that's what I read on. This was the first trip I'd ever taken where I took no books in print, no printed, you know, no real books.
Makes your load light.
It does make your load light, and that's the benefit of it. And the beauty of it, because
it doesn't smell.
Well, you're in some place, you know, we're in these bed and breakfasts, and I would say, gosh, you know, we're, you know, so close to Bath. That reminds me of blah blah blah, Jane Eyre, Jane Austen. You know, maybe I should download that, and you know, then you could dial up, you know, you could go into your library's website and see if they have, you know, one of the books, Sense and Sensibility or something, available and download it, and then you have it. I mean, that's pretty magical.
Isn't it?
It's just pretty great.
Now, I'm going to have to confess to you, Nancy, I hate libraries.
Uh-huh.
I hate them.
Because you have to return the books.
Bingo.
Yes.
And I can't underline. And I can't underline. And I can't dog ear on the best passage of all.
Right.
And I want to own books. I don't want to borrow books.
Well, see, that's what I've discovered is that it's harder for me to use the library now because when I get a book that I've reserved, I no longer am necessarily in the mood for that book. And, you know, and so what I'm finding is that I really want to own a book that I can read when I'm ready to read it.
Aren't you a bit old for instant gratification?
Yeah, right. right. That's one of the things I've never learned, how to put off that gratification. Very selfish.
That's wonderful.
I have three granddaughters who are 12, 10, and 7.
Perfect
and so
ages.
they're all readers. And I was talking to the middle granddaughter who is 10, and she said to me, we were going for a walk. They live in Virginia. We were going for a walk, and she said, well, you know, what's your favorite book? And so I had to explain to her, as I had to explain to you about the fire. I have no favorite book. You know, I love so many books. I can't choose one. And I said, what's your favorite book? And she said, well, she said, everybody always expects that it'll be Harry Potter. And she said, in fact, it is Harry Potter, but I don't like to say it because everybody because everybody expects that it will be. And then we sort of went into this long, intricate discussion of the ins and outs of Harry Potter and the different characters. So it's really fun. It was fun with my own children to share the books that I loved, but. And fun again, just to give these same books in many cases to grandchildren and have them love to read them too.
Yeah. Does that suggest that you waste a lot of your personal time going to old bookstores and wandering through their shelves?
I do.
You've been busted.
And yes, right. I wander through their shelves and I look at the books on the shelves that I have loved, and and I just want to take them off and give them to people. You know, say, here, you must read this. I mean, it's the Raj Quartet. Oh, have you ever read that? You've got to read that. It's so wonderful. And to sort of see those books on the shelf is both, you know, brings back floods of memories, but also is very sad in a way that nobody's that no one is reading them at this moment, or that I don't know anyone reading them. Because I mean, most of the books that I've read, a lot of the books that I've read, have just been so important to me, you know, and I've picked them for reasons, certain reasons, or I've kept them for certain reasons.
So. Yeah.
I was wondering what gave you the idea for doing
the
book. Everybody reads the same book.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, if everyone reads the same book. Okay.
Thank you.
So when I was at the Seattle Public Library, the Center for the Book, and I was the executive director of the Washington Center for the Book, which was housed at the library, got a grant from what was then the Lila Wallace Foundation to create new audiences for literature. And working with the woman meeting together with both the woman who I worked with at the Center for the Book and an outside consultant, you know, we kind of talked about the things that, some of the things that I thought were the most important, bringing people together to talk about a book, how that builds community, how, you know, talking about difficult things can be made it's much easier to talk about it in terms of the experience described in a book, you know, the things they carried by Tim O'Brien, rather than talking about, you know, your feelings about the Vietnam War or you know, the experience of vets coming back. But to read that and to talk about a book like that gives you a freedom to again, move outside your own experience. And, you know, my idea was that people from all over, again, from all ethnicities, ages, economic levels, would come together and would talk about a particular book, and that the trick would be to pick the right books, you know, pick books that demanded discussion, that when you read them, you could not want to talk about them. And so the first book we did was a book called The Sweet Hereafter by Russell Banks, which is about the death of children in a bus accident, and who was to blame, and told from four different points of view, lots to say about that book. The second book was Ernest Gaines' A Lesson Before Dying, which was about a young black man accused wrongly of a crime and sentenced to death in Mississippi, or Louisiana, I guess, in the 1940s. And a black man who comes in to teach him how to read at the request of the prisoner's grandmother, to teach him how to read so he can die like a man. You can't read that book without wanting to talk to somebody about it. And so, you know, that sense of community, that sense of bringing people together, that sense of getting people to read books that they wouldn't ordinarily read, all of those went into that decision to do this Seattle Reads.
It's a beautiful idea.
And now it's being done, you know, worldwide.
Yeah,
and that's so wonderful.
You changed history.
Well, that's so
you're
wonderful.
You're not just a librarian.
I have lots of help.
I have a question that may either expose my complete and utter ignorance, which I always love to do, or it may lead into something. But I'm fascinated, but I haven't studied or thought about it. Women's book groups.
Uh-huh.
Sally belongs to two.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you talk about the reveal, but that phenomena, which both dictates a great the economics of books and editing.
Definitely.
And all that, have you thought or done anything?
Well, you know, part of it, I think, comes out of the fact that, you know, they started really burgeoning in the 1990s.
Right.
And I think that that was the period when people were Robert Putnam's Bowling Alone. It was a period when it was possible, starting to be possible, to go through your day never interacting with another human being.
Ah.
And so I think there was this huge need for people, particularly, I think, young women, maybe young mothers, or people who are working all day, and you want to talk about something besides your children or besides your job, and have some sort of tie-in with some kind of intellectual world. And I think it grew out of that. I think a lot of book clubs don't talk about the book. I hear from many people. They go around and say, how has everybody been? Where they kind of maybe turn into more, group therapy.
Nancy, do you have any insights or inspirations you want to pass on here, Closey? Because this has been really wonderful.
Well, I guess the only... I guess I would just say that really reading should be pleasure. It should be joy. And that's not to say that kids shouldn't have school assignments but if you're reading a book that you're not enjoying, unless it's for your book club, which you should then finish it if it's for your book club, or if it's a school assignment. But it's just so important to enjoy it and to understand that no matter what it is, from the lowliest bodice ripper Regency romance to the most exalted classic, you get things from those books. You learn things from those books. Every book you read changes you in some way. And I think it's so important.
There's neuroscience research about the plasticity of the brain and the rewiring that occurs in reading.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Well, Nancy, I cannot thank you enough for taking this time.
Well,
this
I
has
hope
been,
it was okay.
Oh, it's been
it was wonderful.
Wonderful.
Oh,
and despite the fact that people behind your back call you the librarian, we like you.
Right.
Yeah, would you do that? Would you? What? That's it. One more time, please. Knew it, the librarian. That's wonderful.
I love it.
Thank you ever so much.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. Great.
Tell me what this is in your hand.
So this is a 5-inch plastic action figure of a librarian. It's called the Librarian Action Figure. It was made by a company called Accoutrements, which has a store in Seattle called Archie McPhee. And it was the first ones came out, and this was one of the first ones in fall of 2003, and now it's been discontinued.
What a shame!
So
that's wonderful. And what does that action figure do, Nancy?
Well, if you, I think this is glued. So, but if you cock the arm and just
why don't you pretend you're the action figure?
If you cock the arm in just the right way, and somebody pushes a button on the back, this little button. Then the arm comes up and goes, well, it just comes up, and then you imagine it saying, shh.
Wonderful.
Bravo.
Yay.